ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Right, time to get to work. Hey, everyone! Let's crush it today, all right? All right, time to get to Brisbane. Woo! That was epic. Ooh, time to go home now. Why am I so tired? Hello, I'm Lisa Leong. Welcome to This Working Life on ABC Radio National, helping to make your work life better. Are you just too tired to work? Australians feel exhausted. 8 in 10 Australian knowledge workers reported being on the verge of burnout last year, and businesses are scrambling to catch up with the cost of mental fatigue. So why are we so tired, and what can we do about it? Professor Drew Dawson is Director of Research Development at Central Queensland University, and he's an expert in fatigue management strategy in Australian workplaces. You are the right man for us, Drew. Hello.
Hi, good morning, Lisa.
Well, I want to start with a definition. So what is fatigue?
Oh, that's a really vexed question because, unfortunately, in the English language, it involves a whole bunch of different things. So it can be physical fatigue, it can be mental fatigue, it can be emotional fatigue. And the burnout you were referring to a little bit earlier was probably as much emotional fatigue. But from my perspective, I'm really interested in how much sleep people get as a result of their working time arrangement, and does that impact on their safety and other people's, and does it impact on their long-term health and well-being? So for us, it's mainly about sleep loss rather than overwork.
And so these terms that we are using to describe how difficult it feels sometimes at work, whether it be burnout, overwhelm, tiredness or fatigue. What's a useful way to frame that then so that we have a common language, Drew?
Well, the academics have been arguing about that since 1910, so I'm not sure we've actually got there. Usually we're talking about it in terms of where your working life reduces the amount of sleep you get, and that loss of sleep impacts on your mental capacity. From the health and safety and well-being psychosocial risk perspective, it's mainly about, is the employer providing the employee with an adequate opportunity to rest, recover, and come back to work fit for work, if you look at it from that perspective.
So what's best to measure as a researcher, Drew?
There's a whole bunch of measures, but the ultimate problem that we have is that fatigue is an unverifiable internal psychological state. So there's no fatigue meter, although sometimes when you look at people's faces, that certainly does look like one. But typically we measure fatigue by performance impairment or how long you can resist falling asleep. So we have a terrible test called the multiple sleep latency test, where we put you in a dark room lying down, absolutely quiet, and then we say, try and stay awake, and then we measure how long you can stay awake for. And people who are tired can't do that for more than about 4 or 5 minutes. An average person who's well-rested can do it for more than 20. But we also have what I call the computer tests, the button-pushing tests, where we measure reaction time, logical thinking, all of the kind of knowledge task skills that people need in terms of memory or performance. And we can measure that quite accurately, but it's only ever a proxy for fatigue. That is, we're focused on how fatigue affects your performance, so we measure your performance and then infer back from that you must be this tired.
Is this a sort of test that we can do in our own workplaces, Drew?
Oh, yeah, there's a whole set of kit that's available on the internet for companies to buy and all of that kind of stuff. You have to be a bit careful with it because the marketing claims far outweigh the scientific defensibility in many cases. But it actually turns out NASA did a whole bunch of research about this 20 years ago and said, they had EEGs and button pushing tests, all of this kind of technology. And then it turned out that the best way to work out how fatigued somebody was to ask them.
Are we a good judge of that, do you think, Drew?
people are very good at telling you how tired they are, but or fatigued they are. But what gets in the way is what is the consequence of me saying that? For example, if it means I'm not going to get the overtime shift, if it means my boss is going to yell at me because they think that I'm not going to come to work, there's a whole bunch of cultural and situational factors that sit around that decision to acknowledge that you're fatigued. But we see in the new National Heavy Vehicle Regulations that have just come in this year, a driver can, in effect, say, I'm too tired to drive safely, and then is legally supported to actually stop driving. So we're starting to understand people can tell you how fatigued they are, but they can't, for example, tell you how safe they are. They can't tell you whether they're going to fall asleep in the next 2 minutes. But we have lots of tools that workplaces can use to get a handle on how fatigued your workforce is and what that's costing you as a business by not managing it.
Well, what are some of the dangers?
People do dumb stuff when they're fatigued. And I spend a lot of time in workplaces going, tell me all the dumb stuff you do when you're fatigued. I don't hear much. And then I say, tell me all the dumb stuff other people do when they're fatigued. And so, of course, in that situation, you find everybody knows about other people doing dumb stuff when they're fatigued. So we basically see there's two kinds of risks. There's performance impairment, and that's where you don't do your job as well and you miss something and that leads to an error. At the worst end, you fall asleep driving home and then you die. So, and we have seen a huge number of court cases in the last 20 years where people having major vehicle accidents, having fallen asleep while driving, has been tied back not to the driver themselves, but the working system that they have been embedded within. So shift workers who haven't been managed with respect to fatigue, whose organisations don't have fatigue risk management programs, somebody falls asleep, and if it's a big company, lawyers get very interested in that.
And Drew, I was thinking that it depends a lot on the culture as well, because if there's a culture where you need to mask a little bit how tired you are, then that can contribute to this, and it's quite hard to finger point there.
Yeah, it is. And probably the area where we see the greatest concern about that is in what we call government-funded first responders. So firefighters, doctors, ambulance operators, because yes, they are fatigued and that does increase the level of risk, but the risk associated with not providing the service in many cases is greater. So when we work with companies, a lot of the time we're saying to them, you need how to work out how to work safely when fatigued, because you can't get rid of fatigue if you're going to work at 3 o'clock in the morning. So there's a whole bunch of issues around how do you identify that risk, how do you quantify it, and how do you manage it. Nobody's expected to be perfect, but you are expected to actually try.
So if we are feeling really tired in the workplace, Drew, what's a suggestion for a good way to express it that might help avoid any stigma around being tired in the workplace?
Well, I think the first thing is for organisations to think, is this a forbidden narrative? Is this something we're not allowed to talk about in our workplace? And in a lot of workplaces, it is a forbidden narrative. Don't talk about fatigue because it'll cost us 10% in the next enterprise agreement, or don't talk about fatigue because then I'm not going to be available, I can't get overtime. It is a very contingent conversation. So we spend a lot of time with organisations saying, let's just talk about it, but let's not talk about it while we're negotiating our EBA. Let's not talk about it in the context of an accident. Let's talk about it in advance. And I think that's the first step. The second thing is, and what you refer to, is we try to change the language. So, and I've probably got into trouble for this, but in a lot of organisations, when somebody reported being fatigued, it was heard, I'm tired. That is, it was seen as, well, you know, a form of weakness. On the other hand, now we structure the reporting language so somebody goes to their line manager and says, I didn't have enough sleep last night to work safely. That sounds very different. And because it's what we call coded language, the supervisor goes, oh, when somebody says that, I have to follow a process. Once you give people a clear process to follow, it's relatively straightforward. I'm too tired to work safely. Okay, what are we going to do to manage that fatigue? Well, you probably won't go and work on the drag line, but we can put you into the warehouse where you can't get into trouble. And it's legitimizing that narrative and making sure that people know when somebody's fatigued, what's my decision pathway for how to manage that risk? And once you get that in place, the rest is simple. People know what to do. Mostly they're doing it anyway, but informally, not formally. So good managers know when people are fatigued and take them out of risk, but they're usually breaking the rules to make the place safe.
Dr. Drew Dawson is a professor at Central Queensland University and a researcher of workplace fatigue and, of course, sleepiness. Thanks, Drew.
My pleasure.
It's This Working Life on ABC Radio National with me, Lisa Leong. Dr. Elizabeth Stevens is an Associate Professor of Cultural Studies at the University of Queensland, and she's the co-author of a new study. It's called A Cultural History of Workplace Fatigue. They're just kicking off that study, aiming to finish in 2029. Elizabeth, hello.
Thanks for having me on, Lisa.
Well, this is all very fascinating. What do we understand about the history of fatigue at work, Elizabeth?
Oh, look, it's such an interesting story because, of course, the history of fatigue is much longer than the history of workplace fatigue. People have been getting tired for a long time. There are stories and books from back in medieval times of people complaining how hard they've been working on the land, how long those pilgrim marches were. So people have been getting tired by a lot of things over different times. But what's interesting with the history of workplace fatigue is what starts to make us tired in the workplace. And at what point when people start working in factories and with machines is there considered to be a bit of a disjunct between what our human bodies can do and what our workplaces are requiring of us?
And so what's something surprising that you found in the research that you'd love to share with us?
One of my favourite recent discoveries is we talk a lot these days about the idea of brain fog. A lot of us feel like we're suffering from brain fog. We think of it as a very like brain rotting, a very contemporary kind of condition caused by the contemporary technologies we use and the pace of everyday life. So I was rather charmed to discover quite recently that there is a mid-19th century equivalent concept that was called brain fag, as in we still use the word that way, as in to be fagged out, to be tired. The idea that your brain could get tired from doing cognitive labour is not, in fact, a new concept at all. It's a concept that comes from the mid-19th century when people started to work in office places and suddenly their human brains were required to process a lot more information than they had been beforehand. And the idea that that was a particular kind of tiredness caused by intellectual labour, is in fact not a new concept. It's a concept that goes all the way back to the 19th century.
And so is it now chronic though?
You know, there was a sense in the 19th century when we started to get sort of contemporary cities as well, that suddenly people were living in urban areas, everything was jangly, it was loud, it was artificial, you have tram cars and trains, everything's making a lot of noise on the street. There was an idea that people lived in apartments, that this artificial, loud form of life was bad for people's brains, that it was overstimulating and it was causing a particular kind of new mental fatigue that hadn't existed before. I think people would say we're in a similar moment right now with the rise of AI, people use so many more technologies, that we're never off, we're never disconnected from our devices. And so we're experiencing a real uptick in the intensity of that feeling of mental fatigue.
And do you think, in a way, it feels somewhat inevitable when you're talking about the history that the way in which we're operating is leading to this general feeling of fatigue, and maybe it is even more frustrating because we're maybe blaming ourselves for a feeling that's not our fault?
Indeed, fatigue is one of those experiences that people experience as a kind of failing, an incapacity. I'm too tired to go out this evening. I'm too tired to do the things that, to eat well, to do the things that I know I should do. That's on me. It's a personal failing of energy on my part. And we don't look at the demands of everyday life that are not just in the workplace, but the feeling that we're supposed to be, have work work-life balance, that so, you know, our private life should be maximized and optimized and we should be doing that in as rewarding a way, you know, as possible. All of these demands on our time inevitably make people tired, but we often don't think it's the outside world. It's my workplace and what my family needs and what the requirements of my everyday life are that's making me tired. We feel like it's a failing on our own part. It's very much baked into the narrative about fatigue.
Yeah, I was even thinking that the common question I would hear people saying is, why am I so tired?
And what can I do to make myself feel more energetic? If I'm feeling tired, maybe I need to restart an exercise program, or I need to look at what I'm eating. And so we put more demands on ourselves because we feel like tiredness or fatigue, the dominant cultural narratives about those are that they are failings, that it's an incapacity, it's a form of temporary disability, if you like. We have a lot of judgments about those feelings. It's why people are often concerned to say at work that they're experiencing conditions like brain fog, for instance, to seek disability accommodations for conditions like brain fog, or why people don't want to tell their boss that they're feeling too tired to manage the workload they're being asked to, because we feel like it's a failing.
Do you have a hypothesis if there is a particular group of workers that's more susceptible?
Yes, look, it's different drivers at different points, and it does depend on what you're looking at, what experiences of fatigue that you're looking at the moment. But to take an example that people are talking about a lot at the moment, and the way that new technologies, particularly artificial intelligence, integrated technologies, are transforming workplaces and sectors across a whole range of fields, that becomes a particular driver of certain problems that affects different groups in different ways. So the fact that people now, as a part of a lot of jobs, and very quickly, people are expected to learn technologies that are in the process of changing on a regular basis. So you're not just learning how a new technology works like a typewriter, you're learning how a new operating system works that's being updated every 3 months.
Yeah.
The amount of cognitive bandwidth that's taking is new because they're changing a lot faster. So people who are older might find that harder to keep abreast of. People whose cultural background might mean that they haven't been so integrated with those technologies for a young age, might find that that takes a lot more bandwidth to look at. People who are neurodiverse as well might find that rate of technological change more challenging. So different groups will find different things challenging according to what the drivers of fatigue are.
And what's your feeling around the word productivity?
Oh, thorny word. So it's one of those words that it seems hard to disagree with the idea of productivity. We all want to be healthier and happier and more productive. Who wants to be less of any of those things? And yet it's such a dangerous word, because what is maximum productivity? We never ask that. So there is an expectation. There's a lot of self-help advice for us these days of how we can optimize our productivity, not just in our work life, but in every aspect of, so we can, you know, be 100% in our home life and in our private life as well as in our work life as well. We have the danger with a world in which we measure everything is that we think that we can hit 100%. In fact, that we can change ourselves to make 100% even higher than it was before is the real ambition. There's no limit to how efficient or productive we understand ourselves to be. I think this makes these very dangerous concepts, because there's no limit to what we can ask of ourselves. Maybe we should ask less of ourselves.
So would you prefer it if we stepped away from this focus on productivity?
Look, I think in the moment in the 21st century that we've lived in, at a time when we're seeing those heat waves grow across Europe as they have been, we're onto the fourth or fifth heat wave over the northern summer in Europe at the moment, I think a lot of people would think that sustainability is quite a nice goal to have at the moment, and that our focus on productivity drives us to want more all the time, and that maybe we have reached a moment of cultural evaluation where we think that sustainability for ourselves as humans, for our workplaces, for the planet that we live on, might be a value that we might prioritise alongside productivity and efficiency.
Oh, thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Lisa.
Dr. Elizabeth Stevens is an Associate Professor of Cultural Studies at the University of Queensland and co-author of the new study, A Cultural History of Workplace Fatigue, which has just kicked off. So that's what's going on. We feel tired. And there are some really good, practical, historical and psychological reasons for that. But knowing it doesn't really help that much, does it? So how can we work on being more awake, more present and less tired while still doing our jobs? In a quest for tools to fight the tiredness we're feeling, we're going to turn to a friend of the show, Dr. Kari Leibowitz. She's a health psychologist, she's a speaker and author of How to Winter, Harness Your Mindset to Thrive on Cold, Dark or Difficult Days. And she has a very clear idea of what we can do immediately.
I lived in San Francisco in Silicon Valley area for 7 years. And so I was really immersed in sort of like, you know, hustle culture, right? That like, if you work more, you achieve more. And of course, if you can be productive the whole time, that might be true for some people, but most people can't do that, right? And actually, now I live in the Netherlands, which is the has the shortest work week in Europe. The average Dutch person works, I think, 36 hours a week, but it's a very productive culture. And I think that we are sometimes confusing busyness and productivity, right? This, we're confusing availability with performance. And so for me, I would start to say, can you draw more lines around your rest and leisure? So something I did a couple of years ago, and you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm not on call for life and death situations, I'm not a lawyer getting called at all hours, but I think, you know, a lot of people who have desk jobs, computer jobs, things feel like emergencies when they're not. And so a couple of years ago, what I did was I took my work email off my phone because I felt like if it was a really important work thing, anyone who needs me urgently has my phone number. They can call me. And otherwise, when I'm not working, I don't want to be engaging with work. I want to be off. And I was actually doing the work twice. I was reading an email, composing a response to it in my head, then finishing whatever I was doing, and then later going down and sitting at my computer and writing back to that email. And so that was definitely wearing me out. And so the question is, are there places where you can be more protective of your time that actually is in service of your goal of being productive and efficient? Where you say, these are the hours I'm on and I'm available, and these are the times that I'm off. Another thing I do in my own life is I observe a work Shabbat. So I'm Jewish, and lots of Jews observe a Sabbath from sundown Friday night to sundown Saturday night. I didn't grow up religious observing a Sabbath, but when I started my PhD program at Stanford, where the culture is sort of, you can work on your research 7 days a week, there's always more to do, I decided that I was never going to work on Saturdays. I wasn't going to look at emails. I wasn't going to answer emails. I wasn't going to, you know, engage with my, you know, work in that way. And that has been such a gift. It's something I've been doing for over a decade now, if I don't work on Saturdays, because it's given me total mental freedom, right? I don't even think about checking my work email on Saturdays. I don't even think, oh, I don't have any plans today. Maybe I should just work on that project that, you know, everything's really busy at work. And when I am in a really busy work season, I get to Friday night and I know I'm going to have a break. And hopefully for some listeners, this idea of not working on Saturday is so obvious, right? Hopefully most listeners aren't even thinking about work on Saturday or Sunday, right? Or taking a full weekend. But I do think there is this idea of we kind of should be working all the time or available all the time or thinking about work all the time, that really carving out and delineating time that is time for leisure and rest is really powerful and I think makes a really big difference.
Our thanks to Dr. Kari Leibowitz for those hints and tips. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It was produced by Rob Kelly and engineered by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Narm, Melbourne. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can like or subscribe to our show on ABC Listen or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please rate and review us while you're there. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next time, rest up.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.